This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is Mark Darcy at Westminster with the Today in Parliament podcast for Tuesday, the 31st of October, when Labour accused the government of failing to act to tackle problem gambling.
The government had a strong hand to play, but this is a busted flush.
Also tonight, a million faulty tumble dryers. The manufacturer faces criticism over its response.
There are a whole range of things that Whirlpool have failed to do through this process. The critical one, though, is that they have failed to recall these machines.
The Brexit secretary tells Piers the UK will reach some form of agreement with the EU.
If we can't get an outcome where we can agree on a free trade and a customs arrangement, we'll be a basic deal.
And not good enough, Islanders' verdict on the British relief effort in the hurricane-hit Caribbean. But first, the government's been accused of kicking the issue of problem gambling into the long grass after announcing a public consultation on plans to curb the stakes on fixed-odds betting terminals, which critics call the crack cocaine of gambling. At the moment, people can bet up to £100 every 20 seconds on the machines, but this could be cut to something between £2 and £50. Responding to an urgent Commons question, the Culture Minister, Tracy Crouch, said the government accepted that fixed-odds betting terminals, or FOBTs, posed a problem.
The current regulation of FOBTs is inappropriate to achieve our stated objective of protecting consumers and wider communities. We are therefore consulting on regulatory changes to the maximum stake, looking at options between £50 and £2 in order to reduce the potential for large losses and therefore the potential harmful impact on the player, their families and the wider community.
The urgent question was put down by Labour's Shadow Culture Secretary Tom Watson. He said the government should act now.
Let's look at the public policy challenge we face in this house. 430,000 people addicted to gambling, up a third in 3 years. A further 2 million problem gamblers at risk of developing an addiction. £1.8 billion lost on FOBTs each year.
Mr. Watson said the announcement of a further consultation had left gambling industry lobbyists grinning from ear to ear.
This is a missed opportunity. A missed opportunity to settle the issue of FOBTs once and for all. Quite frankly, we expected more. The government had a strong hand to play, but this is a busted flush. Yeah.
But the minister hit back at Tom Watson, saying it was Labour who had relaxed the betting laws.
I'm pleased to see his conversion on this issue. He was, of course, a minister in the government that took through the legislation that liberalised gambling and caused the harm that many, many people have suffered as a consequence of these machines.
The Conservative backbencher Philip Davis said FOBTs were not the biggest issue.
The highest levels of problem gambling were in spread betting, then through betting on a betting exchange, then through playing poker in pubs or clubs, then betting online on events other than sports or horse racing or greyhound racing, and only then followed by playing gaming machines in bookmakers. Given that those much higher levels of problem gambling all come with unlimited stakes and unlimited potential winnings, if the government is so obsessed with evidence, why is it just focusing so much on betting machines in bookmakers, or is this just playing to the gallery?
For the SNP, Brendan O'Hara said the Scottish government was ready to act now, given the powers.
In Scotland, £4 billion is spent every year on 2,000 gaming machines, and this is at a time when more people are being identified as being problem or at-risk gamblers. Action is needed now. And if this Parliament is unwilling to act, then the Scottish Parliament is. So will the Minister start today the process of devolving all gambling powers to the Scottish Parliament?
The Liberal Democrat Christine Jardine feared that restrictions on machines in betting shops would drive problem gamblers elsewhere.
Given the danger that people who want to make large bets will be pushed online to the less regulated area, that perhaps they could consider extending the consultation to address stakes on online equivalents such as blackjack, where thousands of pounds can be bet on one hand and lost.
And the Northern Ireland Democratic Unionist Ian Paisley thought there should be more focus on gambling advertisements.
There are 5.5 lines in this report on television broadcasting, yet everyone knows that it's gambling adverts that are doing more damage to people than probably FOBTs.
The consultation goes on till January the 23rd next year, after which ministers will decide what action to take. The domestic appliance supplier Whirlpool has told MPs that 1 million faulty tumble dryers could still be in use. The firm started a repair programme after discovering a fault in 2015, but safety experts think it should have conducted a full product recall instead. Christina Cooper reports.
When Whirlpool discovered that a build-up of fluff was causing a fire hazard, it set about repairing over 5 million tumble dryers. The following year, in August 2016, a machine awaiting repairs caused a major fire at a tower block in West London. Peter Morey, head of campaigns at Which, said Whirlpool should have recalled the tumble dryers, not repaired them.
By 2016, 750 fires had been reportedly linked to these tumble dryers. And then, of course, in August of that year, you had the Shepherd's Bush fire, where a tower block burned down and tragically, it left 50 people unable to return to their homes.
Whirlpool originally advised that machines needing repairs were still safe to use, as long as they weren't left unattended. It changed its advice earlier this year, telling customers not to use them at all. Peter Morey again.
There are a whole range of things that Whirlpool have failed to do through this process. The critical one, though, is that they have failed to recall these machines.
A view reinforced by Charlie Pugsley, the head of investigations at the London Fire Brigade. He wrote to Whirlpool 6 months before the fire in West London.
And expressed my concern about the advice being given to them that it was safe to use. And subsequently, regrettably, 6 months later, we had all those people displaced and what we would certainly regard as a near miss. Because had that fire been at night time, could have been a different picture.
The business committee is investigating whether the product safety regime is fit for purpose, which is calling for a national body to replace the current network of local trading standards offices. Martin Allen from Electrical Safety First suggested a registration system, so when problems come up, manufacturers know where their products are.
Consumers need also to be given a fighting chance, so when you see a recall notice, the language needs to be clear, tell them exactly what they need to do, exactly what the risk is, so they're more likely to take action for themselves.
The Labour Committee member Peter Kyle was starting to feel a bit nervous.
I mean, I've got to tell you, I'm too scared to put my washing machine on after listening to you three.
So
next to give evidence was Whirlpool's communications director Ian Moverley. He told MPs that when the firm discovered the fault, it approached trading standards offices in Peterborough, where the company is based, for guidance.
It was determined that a corrective action was to be taken, and part of that then discussion was to then enact a repair programme, and that's what we did immediately from that point and took a number of steps to ensure that we did that diligently, responsibly, and took that straight out to the market.
Labour Committee member Albert Owen was curious about Whirlpool's advice not to leave machines unattended.
People live busy lives these days, don't they? And they, you know, they've got these new products and digital, and we're told to go smart on everything and automatic. I mean, do you think that's, in this period, is a sound advice?
Ian Moverley called it standard advice.
Whether it be a product that's subject to this action or not, with something like that. You know,
well, I'm getting even more scary now as somebody owns one of your products.
The committee chair, Labour's Rachel Reeves, wondered how many potential faulty tumble dryers still needed repairs.
How many of these tumble dryers do you think are in British homes today?
We think potentially maybe 1 million is the estimate on that point of view.
He said it was recognised that Whirlpool's programme had achieved a significant number of resolutions. He also told MPs that he'd carried on using his tumble dryer before it had been modified.
Christina Cooper. Now, the Brexit Secretary, David Davis, has been pressed over the prospect of there being no agreement with the European Union over the UK's departure in 2019. He was appearing before a Lords committee, and the Conservative and former Minister Lord Selkirk wondered what would happen if the negotiations ended in a stalemate and no deal before the deadline.
What does no deal mean in practice, and what would be the consequences for the United Kingdom if there were to be no deal under Article 50.
David Davis wanted to be clear about which camp he was in.
The first thing to say is right at the beginning, no deal is not what we're seeking. I mean, I may sound like a crack record on this, but unfortunately, every time you don't say it, people assume that somehow you want no deal. I am not one of those people who think no deal is the best deal.
But if there was no deal, he thought that really just meant no deal on trade and customs. There'd still be what he called a basic deal on things like security and aviation.
It is so patently in everybody's interest that we have, let's say, an aviation deal. You know, not just for us, not just for our holidaymakers, but what would it do to the economy of Spain or Italy or countries which have got heavily dependent regions on tourism? Or what would it do to Poland if the million Poles in Britain could not go backwards and forwards between them? So I think the sort of what is commonly thought of as no deal is almost, it's not impossible, but it's very, very, very improbable. Much more likely if we come to that point, if we can't get an outcome where we can agree on a free trade and a customs arrangement, will be a basic deal.
Lord Jay, an independent or crossbench peer, used to be head of the diplomatic service. He wanted to know how a withdrawal deal linked to the UK's future relationship with the European Union and which got agreed first. For David Davis, they were inextricably linked.
In the infamous words, or the famous words, of the European Union, nothing is agreed till everything's agreed. And we see these being as linked to each other. The withdrawal agreement, on balance, will probably favour the Union in terms of the things like money and so on. Whereas the future relationship will favour both sides and will be important to both of us.
Lord Jay wondered if that was only David Davis's view of the talks.
Do you have the impression that the Michel Barnier and the EU side will agree with that interpretation?
It's a question you really need to put to him because, I mean, my view is yes, he understands it. Whether he believes it will be as precise as we believe it will be, I don't know at this stage. He has used words like scoping and framework rather than agreement.
At the moment, the sticking point is still money. The EU wants to finalise what the UK will pay when it leaves before talking about trade deals. The UK wants the two to go hand in hand. Mr Davis said he would, after all, have to sell it back home.
If the British public is suddenly told, I'm not going to pick a number, but some enormous number is going to be paid over to them and we haven't got a deal, they might take a slightly different view than if we find ourselves with a trade deal and a deep and special partnership, what we want to do. They might take a slightly different view. And this reflects the fact that we see this as more of a political principle, a political obligation, than a legal one.
The Brexit Secretary, David Davis. You're listening to Today in Parliament on BBC Radio 4 with me, Mark Darcy. Still to come, a plea to make public transport safer.
These old tyres kill. Let's get them off our coaches and buses.
But first, a cross-party group of peers has recommended that the membership of the House of Lords be cut by a quarter. It's said that the size of the 800-strong chamber should be capped at 600 peers and that new peers should be appointed in line with general election results. It's also urged the political parties to sign up to a two-out, one-in system to hit the new level of peers in just over a decade, with the new arrivals serving a maximum of 15 years. The recommendations came from a committee set up by the Lord Speaker, Lord Fowler, who made a brief statement.
My Lords, today's report presents a challenge, but it also represents an opportunity. We know that the House is too big. A smaller, more effective House will be able to strengthen public confidence and build support for our vital constitutional role. It is now up to us.
Lord Fowler hoped there'd be a debate on the report before Christmas, with more detailed consideration of specific measures in the new year. Now, a defence chief and a minister have rejected criticism that Britain was too slow in responding to the devastating hurricanes that struck the Caribbean last month. The International Development Committee was told that many islanders felt the British effort was poor. Keith McDougall reports.
Hurricane Irma's effects were brutal.
The main focal point and the main danger for Anguilla is that just about all of our key infrastructure was annihilated.
Blondel Clough from the government of Anguilla, a British territory in the Caribbean that was in the path of Hurricane Irma, considered the most powerful Atlantic storm in a decade. Tracy Knight is from the government of the Turks and Caicos Islands.
400 homes were completely destroyed and there was a need to shelter approximately 1,000 persons before both Hurricanes Irma and Hurricane Marie.
Blondel Clough praised the resilience of the Anguilla people, who'd got on with rebuilding their homes once the hurricane had passed. Some islands in the Caribbean, not under British jurisdiction, had seen looting.
Social disorder kicked in, civil unrest kicked in, armed looting and the like. So that did not prevent that situation arising. Whereas in Anguilla, there was no sort of lawlessness at all, even though we lost the roof of our prison. I believe our prisoners sat tight and waited for it to be put back on.
But were the residents happy with the help they received from Britain? A landing ship of the Royal Fleet Auxiliary Service, Mounts Bay, brought in aid, but a Times journalist, Catherine Philp, who'd been to the area, said islanders were sceptical.
It was this lag time, that how long it took even for Mounts Bay to get there, and it was, and obviously the French and the Dutch have a different situation where they had permanent, they had troops based in the area, and the British military, it was an amphibious sort of way of approaching the issue. So they didn't have people. They felt that they. So I think there was an issue of contrast. I mean, one person used the phrase third class citizens. We feel like third class citizens because seeing that contrast with the French and the Dutch.
Another Times journalist, Deborah Haynes, had with her the notes of a reporter embedded with the British military team.
She sort of wrote a summary that said, from the few conversations I was able to have with local people, it appeared that while shifting boxes of aid from the backs of trucks and planes made good pictures for PR purposes, they were not the resources required at the time. The main issue faced by islanders was the lack of power, communications and transport. The boxes of aid were regarded as a drop in the ocean. She said, all in all, it seems that the most positive thing to come out of British efforts in the region was to have a presence on the streets. In the eyes of the islanders, this appeared to be the bulk of the British contribution.
Defending the British relief effort was Air Vice Marshal Edward Stringer, an assistant chief of the defence staff. He said it was lazy journalism to say the French had more ships involved in the relief effort than the British. What about size and capacity?
Mounts Bay is a 16,000-tonne floating workshop and dock.
It was a veritable Thunderbird too, he said, for those who remember the era of international rescue. He said there hadn't been a delay in deploying Mounts Bay. It was gearing up for action, even as meetings in Whitehall of the government's emergency committee, COBRA, were being held.
And so even though our forces were at 48 hours notice to move, in fact the Marines were at RAF Brize Norton within 8 hours on the first night, and the first aircraft, you mentioned the first one, but three left on that Friday, they all moved within around 24 hours of the COBRA sitting against a 48-hour timeline. So that is the speed with which we responded.
The International Development Minister, Lord Bates, said the aid mission had been triggered as soon as the hurricane struck Anguilla. He told the committee the government reluctantly worked within rules that prevented funds from Britain's international aid budget going to help the Caribbean islands as they were deemed too wealthy. But later in the day, the OECD group of richer nations announced a relaxing of the rules. So from now on, aid money can be used to help stricken Caribbean islands.
Keith McDougall. It's been reported that the government is drawing up plans so that prisoners sentenced to less than a year in jail and who are let out on day release could be allowed to return home to vote. Since 2005, the UK government's been in breach of a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights, which said the current blanket ban on prisoner voting breached the right to free and fair elections. At Question Time, a Conservative MP, Philip Davis, described the idea of giving prisoners the right to vote as ridiculous.
Nobody's taking the vote away from prisoners, they're taking it away from themselves. And if voting was so important to them, perhaps they wouldn't have committed the crimes in the first place that led them being sent to prison.
But the Conservative and former Attorney General Dominic Grieve welcomed the move.
It's high time that we remedied something which places us in a very small category of countries. Most countries manage to allow their prisoners to vote, or certainly those sentenced to short sentences of imprisonment, without the world coming to an end.
The Justice Secretary, David Lidington, said ministers were preparing their position ahead of a meeting of the Council of Europe in December and would tell MPs about it in the coming weeks. Later, MPs completed their consideration of the finance bill, which puts the remnants of the March budget into law. Labour MPs criticised moves to cut the £30,000 tax threshold for redundancy payments, and there were calls for a review of capital gains on commercial property sold off by UK taxpayers who live overseas. In the Lords, the government suffered a defeat after Peers backed a cross-party proposal to make sure anyone who transfers out of a pension gets financial advice. The change to the Financial Guidance and Claims Bill, approved by a majority of 82 votes, requires people to be asked if they've received information or guidance before transferring out of a pension scheme or withdrawing their assets. Now, the Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt has already announced that the public sector pay cap, limiting rises to 1% a year, is to be abolished for staff in the NHS in England and Wales. But where is the money to pay for it going to come from? Appearing on the BBC's Andrew Marr show at the weekend, Mr Hunt appeared to suggest that the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, was proposing to link extra money to better productivity. When he appeared before the Health Committee, a Conservative, Johnny Mercer, pressed Mr Hunt on what that meant.
Any sort of pay increase, is that going to come with a sort of tightening of the screw on efficiencies within the NHS, or is that going to come from extra money that may come from the Chancellor?
Well, what the Chancellor has said is that he will consider providing extra money if I am able to secure some productivity improvements.
The Conservative who chairs the committee, Sarah Williston, who's also a family doctor, tried to pin that productivity comment down.
Is he saying that it all has to come out of that, or that there'll be some kind of mixture of the two?
He hasn't given me any more detail than I've given you on this matter. It's that he will consider finding extra funding so that it wouldn't have any pay rise, wouldn't all or in part have to come out of savings in the rest of the NHS, but he would like to see some productivity improvements negotiated as part of those contractual changes.
MPs then turned to another news story, reports that a group of GPs are considering quitting the NHS to go private, with the ability to charge patients. Jeremy Hunt reckoned the real question was why the idea was being discussed at all.
GPs feel that their workload is too high, their job has become too stressful. Sometimes they feel that they're on a sort of hamster wheel of between 30 and 40 10-minute appointments every day, and it's exhausting. And the long-term solution to that is to get more capacity into the system.
He said that was why the government had a plan to recruit 5,000 more GPs, and that was the long-term solution. The Paralympic gold medalist Tanny Gray-Thompson has agreed with MPs that the classification of Paralympic athletes has been manipulated. But the British Paralympic Association has denied that the system is failing and insisted there hadn't been one proven case. Alicia McCarthy reports.
The Commons Sport Committee is looking at whether some Paralympic athletes have been given an unfair advantage by being grouped with competitors more disabled than themselves. Appearing before the MPs was the 11-time Paralympic champion Lady Gray-Thompson. The chair, the Conservative Damien Collins, asked her if there was a problem.
Do you believe that the system of classification is open to abuse and is being abused at the moment?
Yes.
Yes.
She believed the UK should take a lead in creating more rigorous standards of classification. Damien Collins asked why.
From your position, based on what you know and what you've experienced, you believe that more needs to be done because the current system isn't working.
We should be the gold standard. We should have integrity at the heart of everything we do. There should be independence. And I think we can achieve that.
Yeah, but you said yes. When you said yes, you believe the system is being abused at the moment. You believe that is happening now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also giving evidence to the MPs was Michael Breen, father of Paralympian sprinter and long jumper Olivia Breen, who campaigns for a more rigorous classification system. It was, he said, a sensitive topic.
You're told that you're not allowed to discuss classification, and in some instances you're actually told that you're not allowed to discuss the classification of a specific athlete who's then named. So, in addition to that, you have a scenario whereby you're told that if you step out of line, then they'll set their lawyers on you, which is exactly what happened with me.
He said the ultimate sanction was deselection. His daughter was dropped from the relay team at the last moment. Many athletes have contacted the committee with their concerns, most of them anonymously. But Damien Collins, the Conservative chair, quoted from one, Ian Jones.
He talks about going to a being reclassified in Indianapolis in the run-up to the London 2012 Games, and he was a T44 athlete. Yeah. And he said, for some reason, I was reclassified as a T38 athlete, which is the cerebral palsy class. I was never diagnosed with cerebral palsy. I have no medical evidence saying I had cerebral palsy. And I clearly told the classifiers on the panel that I did not have cerebral palsy. The whole thing is a mess. And he then duly won the race in Indianapolis, a 400 metres race, by 150 metres clear.
Yeah, and he felt acutely embarrassed, that athlete. He didn't want to be there. He told them not to classify him into that class, and they did it anyway.
The International Paralympic Committee, the IPC, sets the classifications. No one from the IPC was available to give evidence in person, but it issued 9 pages of evidence. Tim Hollingsworth, chief of the British Paralympic Association, did talk to the MPs and tried to calm the concerns.
I don't believe where we're at now is in a position where we're looking at something that can be considered not fit for purpose. I don't believe that. I think there are absolutely areas, and I'm sure we'll touch on them, where this process and the underpinning nature of classification can and must be improved. But that is not to say that the sport as a whole and the athletes as a whole are being failed.
Damian Collins asked if athletes failed by the system, as he put it, were owed an apology. Tim Hollingsworth said there had not been a proven case of intentional misrepresentation.
There has not indeed been any evidence that has been presented that has gone beyond the circumstantial and the anecdotal.
My answer is, if
I were to say that, it would be to not defend the right of those athletes who are otherwise being accused.
Asked again if an apology was owed, he replied that in the absence of any evidence, his answer was no.
Alicia McCarthy. Finally, there's been a call for a ban on the use of tyres which are more than 10 years old on buses and coaches. The demand from Labour's Maria Eagle was prompted by a crash in 2012 involving a coach taking people back to Liverpool from a music festival on the Isle of Wight. 3 people were killed, amongst them 18-year-old Michael Molloy.
His mother, Frances, is heartbroken. She thought coach travel was a safe form of public transport. Yet the coach to which she entrusted her son turned out to be a death trap because of a 19-and-a-half-year-old tyre that no one could see was going to burst because of the deterioration caused by its age.
Ms Eagle said it was not unlawful to use old tyres as long as the tread was road legal, and she urged MPs to back a change in the law.
Let those of us now in this House take steps to ensure that no other family has to endure what Frances has endured. Mm-hmm. Mr Speaker, these old tyres kill. Let's get them off our coaches and buses. Let's get them off our roads.
Maria Eagle bringing us to our closing headlines from Westminster. The government has faced demands for early action to tackle problem gambling, and the Brexit secretary has said the UK will get a basic deal with the EU, even if a trade agreement can't be done. I'm Mark Darcy. The editor was Simon Jones. That was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.